Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. If you'd like to find more sessions, interviews, and story podcasts, visit our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. This podcast features a program session from the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Scott Jasek. I'm editor of Inside Higher Ed, and I'm really appreciate that you are all here in this very spacious ballroom. When we saw the schedule, I figured most people would be at the airport or Disney. So I applaud your commitment to the program to be here. First, a question: how many of you are bloggers? Excellent. And of those of you who blog, how many of you would identify yourselves primarily as faculty members, and the rest would be IT administrators with blogs here, IT officials with blogs? Excellent. Okay, so we have here three of Inside Higher Ed's technology bloggers. I like to think that we have the dream team of bloggers. And starting closest to me, we have Eric Stoller, Joshua Kim, and Casey Green. And we're going to talk today about blogging and information technology. We want to keep this pretty informal and make it possible for you all to ask questions. And I would invite any of you in the back who want to have closer access to these great bloggers to consider moving up. But for those of you who are in the back, can you hear okay? Okay, excellent. So just very briefly, part of why I think it's interesting to talk about information technology bloggers in higher ed is that there is a ton of discussion about faculty blogging in higher education. And there are sort of constant debates about whether having a blog helps you get tenure, hurts your chances of getting tenure. There have been some famous cases of prominent bloggers who didn't get tenure, and then everybody wondered, is it because they had a blog? Fears about senior faculty members who might think it's a waste of time or not necessarily peer-reviewed, so it can't be good. So there's a lot. There's sort of constant debate. We actually just had a blog post on our site about this topic. Likewise, at the very senior ranks of higher education, there is discussion about blogging, and you have more presidents saying that they are blogging, although I'm personally a little bit dubious because a lot of the time I think it is just the PR office putting the letter to alumni on a website and saying, oh, our president has a blog. And while blogs are very different, they aren't just what the PR office puts out. So amid this attention to the faculty role in blogging, presidential interest in blogging, I don't think there's been enough discussion of being an IT blogger in higher education. And so I'd like to start by turning it over to each of our panelists to talk about the questions raised in the program about the advantages and disadvantages of being an IT blogger in higher education, what drew you to it, what you think the issues are. So maybe I'll start with Eric, and we'll just work our way down. If you could each talk briefly about those issues.
Sure. So I've got about an hour and a half.
And maybe also each of you could also briefly describe your blogs.
Absolutely. So I write about student affairs and technology. So I'm sort of one of the oddballs here, I guess, at EDUCAUSE in terms of talking about student life experience, the functional areas sort of outside of the classroom, student involvement, sort of that vice president of student affairs piece that hopefully is coming to EDUCAUSE. It's not necessarily here right now, but in the future. My site right now in terms of what I blog about is sort of a combination of almost how-to, this is what you can use this tool for, that sort of thing, some strategy stuff, some policy, really trying to push the student affairs practitioners into realizing that technology is something that we need as a core competency for our profession. And so the more I can write about that, the better. In terms of one of the advantages of being a blogger is I can be very flexible and very fast. I can literally come up with an idea in the shower, sorry for the imagery, and within 5 minutes get on my laptop, type up something, and it's out there. For people to discuss and comment on, which is, it's kind of a nice way to sort of crowdsource ideas as well, because comments are constantly being put on our blogs with a lot of great ideas that end up providing us more post ideas. Some of the disadvantages, I would say, right now for me, blogging is all about freedom. It's all about getting your voice out there, and it's all about trying to impact people on various levels. So I don't see a huge disadvantage right now to blogging, other than the fact that some folks would see it as a non-traditional medium, which would mean that they might not necessarily approach it because of maybe just some personal stuff, some bias that they have been socialized to have. But I don't see a lot of disadvantages right now. I think that blogs are flexible, blogs are fast, and with what you can do with RSS and everything else, it's a great place to be.
Josh.
Hi, everyone. So I write the technology and learning blog, and I think the reason that I started blogging and what's really important to me is that I see what we do in education technology as an emerging academic discipline, or maybe emerged.
Submerged.
I come out of sociology and I come out of teaching, and I've transitioned into education technology. And in this new profession, it's been frustrating that there's not that many opportunities for open exchange of ideas, for dialogue, and sort of less opportunities to be wrong. And you only kind of learn things when you're wrong about things. So blogging's a great way that I've found to engage in a community, and, you know, like we're sitting here meeting each other. None of that would happen unless we had this platform that lets us talk to each other in an agile way. So I think that's really been great. I do worry about the downsides for people like me who work. I'm at Dartmouth College, and I'm not a faculty member. I don't have tenure, and I don't have those protections. And I'll say things that people don't like, or I'll say things again where I'll be wrong. And I do worry about, there are a lot of advantages to kind of exploring things and getting your ideas out and figuring out what you're thinking and having a community, but there could be some real costs. So, and I don't know what those are, and I don't know what the risks are, and that's the kind of thing I think we need to talk to each other about.
Casey.
Sure. Hi, good morning. I'm Casey Green. I write the Digital Tweed blog for Inside Higher Ed, and in my other life, I'm the Campus Computing Project, which is the largest continuing study of IT in American higher ed. Digital Tweed actually began 11 years ago as a monthly column in Converge magazine. When Converge shifted its format a little bit in its audience, it migrated to Syllabus, which later became Campus Technology, and it was a monthly column there until 1996, and they shifted a little bit. So politely we'll say it went into a bit of a hiatus, and I was delighted and honored when the editors of Inside Higher Ed approached me, or honestly we approached one another, I guess. It was a very tactful dance about resurrecting Digital Tweed and bringing it to Inside Higher Ed. I like blogging, in one sense, for the same thing that Eric said. I like the immediacy. I don't have to wait a month. If I've got an idea, I don't have to wait a month compared to being in a print column when I wrote for other things. I may have nothing to say for a week. I may have three things to say in a week, and it provides that opportunity. And my column wanders the landscape about either individual technologies, about markets, potentially about what some vendors do. The things that I have to be careful about, in part because campus computing is supported by we receive support from some 36 firms that are technology providers to the campus market in hardware, software, services, and publishing. Disclosure to me is very important. I try to be very upfront if I'm writing about an issue in general or making a passing reference to a company to say that this company is a corporate sponsor of campus computing. I think that one of the differences between writing a column and writing a blog is an even higher sense of responsibility about getting the facts right. Doug Letterman and Scott Jasek have been very clear that we're going to give you enough digital rope to hang yourself, and at least I've sort of half hung myself once recently. But I think that there's an even greater responsibility because there's not the traditional kind of editing that goes into this, which is both which is in many ways also is the loss of a kind of a feedback mechanism that the editors serve, and a very helpful one. At least that's been my experience over my career. The other thing that I kind of lament is the absence of feedback. This was somewhat true as a columnist and when I had a print column, and also with the blog, in the sense that the only way I know until I get some monthly stats, if anybody's actually hit that page, if anybody's actually reading it, is if I see a comment. And the absence of comment, I don't know what to make of the absence of comments. Did nobody read it? Nobody liked it? What do I tell my mom about what I did in school today? Or my dad? Let me be clear, it's both. And with that also, for the occasional person who uses the blog as a catalyst to write a question back, often because people don't say, I am Susan Jones or Robert Smith at Acme College, I have no way to respond back to their question. And in the sense that if they had a direct question they'd like to get to me, I wish they would send me email, I could answer it, as opposed to raising a question in the common part of the blog, and then how do I respond to that to know that they go back to it? It's kind of sort of the real-time response to a real-time question.
I wanted to just do some little more audience surveys. So maybe if those of you have blogs could raise your hands again. At the risk of exposing anyone, how many of you, any anonymous bloggers here? I guess that's an unfair question to ask, especially in a room with journalists. But how many of your bosses regularly read your blog? How many of you know that your bosses read your blog? Ever get negative feedback from your bosses about what you're writing about? Any of you ever get that could be good. Any of you get suggestions for blog topics from coworkers or from IT companies? And how many of you write regularly about vendors, about IT companies? Just a few. So most of you do not. Those of you who blog and don't write about, that don't cover those topics, I'd be curious if any of you would shout out what your main focus is. Experience. Others. People in IT. Teaching. I just want to talk briefly from the perspective of an editor of a publication that hosts blogs. One of the things I've noticed is we've added technology blogs. We also have a lot of blogs that while they occasionally touch on technology, they have other topics. We have something called Mama PhD, which is about women balancing their careers and parental duties. We have Confessions of a Community College Dean. We have University Diaries. So we have a bunch of blogs that aren't on technology. And there are very different reactions I get to the technology blogs from the non-technology blogs. And the primary difference relates to the fact that in higher ed technology, there's a lot of money. And there are a lot of corporate players. And so I get a lot of calls or emails from companies who want to know, why are bloggers reacting the way they are? And they don't necessarily understand that we give our bloggers, as they have noted, a lot of independence. So if Josh happens to write something, you know, positive or negative, it's because it's his idea, not because I sent off a note saying, let's bash company X today. And so the other thing that raises is the issue Casey alluded to, which is the issue of conflict of interest and disclosure. And as I've been thinking about that, I actually wonder if we may be too easy on our non-technology blogs, because every blogger in higher education, to take faculty members, they are associated with a certain philosophy in whatever discipline they're in. They may have a textbook publisher of choice. They may have a program they aspire to join. Because of the intersection of money with IT, we tend to be very rigorous about self-disclosure about entities to whom we may have some connection. And I should wonder if we may be too easy on those where the connections aren't clearly financial. I want to, at any point, any of you should please feel free to go to the microphone and raise questions, but I'm going to continue to raise some questions for the panel. And I wonder, maybe starting with Eric, if you could talk a little bit about the fact that you mentioned earlier that student affairs isn't a big techie field, or doesn't think of itself that way. Do you see yourself writing differently for a student affairs audience versus, say, the EDUCAUSE crowd?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, if I said EDUCAUSE to student affairs folks, most of them would say Gesundheit. They probably wouldn't know. I mean, we come from a totally different field that has, historically speaking, technology has been something that you all bring to us, right? It's the IT folks who bring it to the student affairs folks. Student affairs folks traditionally aren't at the table because they don't necessarily know that they should be or can be. And so in terms of who I write for, I'm trying to establish with the folks that are, you know, are my readers, my audience, is that it's okay to think about technology and student affairs while simultaneously giving hugs. And you can quote me on that. Because the student affairs folks, you know, we are student life, we're student experience, student involvement, but we also have financial aid, registrar, enrollment management, conduct issues where there's a lot of things with digital media piracy, and obviously some legislation around that. Accessibility issues are enormous, and a lot of times accessibility areas are going to be located or housed within student life. And so yesterday I wrote a post that came out this morning, I believe, about just being an EDUCAUSE missionary, sort of spreading the good word about student affairs. The hardest thing for me at the vendor exhibit was just going to everyone and saying, okay, well, here's your solution. What's in it for me? What can you bring to the table for student affairs folks? And some folks got it and said, oh, absolutely, this is what's going on with academic advising or financial aid, course registration, things that student affairs folks are really interested in. So it's really, it's a cultural shift to take technology and student affairs from more from being something that other folks do or that it's just a thread within our profession and being a core competency of what student affairs practitioners bring to the table in 2010.
Josh, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of how your blog is perceived by the various people you deal with, both at Dartmouth and the EDUCAUSE world, how people react to it, and whether it creates pressures on you on what you should or shouldn't talk about.
Sure. So one of the big things that I talk about a lot in my blog is companies. I'm very interested in the ed tech companies, and mostly I'm interested in the people who work at these companies, because I spent a couple of years during the whole dot-com boom working in the for-profit sector, so I have some insight. And I really strongly believe that the people who are working in educational technology companies, that these people are educators, and that they're working in these companies because they feel like it's the very best possible route to change the status quo in education. And that's why they're there. And I very much feel like if things had been different at all, they could be in my shoes and I could be in their shoes. But I've been frustrated that the people who work in companies don't often have the opportunity to have an independent voice, to be able to talk about their experience in ed tech companies as people, talk about things that they're frustrated with or goals that they have. That often companies try to have a corporate line and strategy comes from the top, as we heard in the Hamel talk. So what I hope in my blog is that I can engage some of these people and have a route that they can engage the community. And I think that part in my blog that you asked has been the most rewarding aspect, because I've gotten to know a lot of these people who work in these tech companies. And then I feel like I can bring those relationships back to my campus. You understand the roadmap. You understand where these companies are going. You understand companies where the culture is in trouble, and maybe you don't want to work with them as much. I think there's more opportunities. I really encourage anyone who works for companies to come on out and participate more in social media.
Casey, I mean, you've been surveying the higher ed technology scene for a while, and in the pre-blog era in addition to the blog era. And I wonder, do you think it has changed the way people talk about higher ed technology, that there are a bunch of voices that maybe don't have institutional backing in the way that might have used to be required to get a voice or a platform?
Yeah, I think the social media aspects of this really do give voice to a lot of folks who would not have had a channel, particularly if they don't have faculty rank, they don't have faculty status, and may also not have a director or senior title within their organizations. That's a good thing. I think it opens some things up. You know, I think that also, though, creates some issues about, as Joshua and Eric have said, there's an issue of some risk potentially. There's some issues about responsibility. Being conscious of that audience for the folks who are doing those kinds of blogs and the context in which they're doing it. And you know, I suspect, again, I'm independent. I'm unencumbered by an institutional identity. You know, often how assertive people have to be, you know, make sure that the disclosure that I'm writing as an observer as opposed to, in this voice, as opposed to an officer of a particular college or university or some other entity. Let me pick up a little bit about Joshua's comments as well about the participation of the technology provider community in these conversations. I've been working with technology firms who have been corporate sponsors of campus technology for 20 years, and even before that, some work I did in my prior life as a real tweed-jacketed academic at UCLA and UCLA with technology firms. We launched the Campus Computing Project in part. There were no data about a lot of the stuff that began in the mid part of the 1980s about academic planning for what then were the microcomputers. And at least it was my firm conviction that this conversation was too important to be just one-sided. It was too important to be driven by opinions alone. It was too important not to involve folks on the corporate side, the technology providers, with people on the campus side. And unfortunately, then, and to a lesser degree, but still some degree now, I feel that too many of my academic colleagues view the technology providers as, and I say this with a little bit of hyperbole, but not much, a little more than pond scum bringing toys and dollars. That crap's got to change. We spend too much money, and there's too much risk not getting this right. And there's too much pressure to be sure that we really do extract value from our technology investments, hardware, software, services, content, the leverage that we can provide. And because there's such a long tail in terms of realizing those investments, what difference does the technology, this is not the industrial model of some increment of technology now provides immediate, visible, realizable, measurable ROI kinds of returns in 6 to 9 months. Ours is a different model, a different culture, a different set of issues. The failure to engage the folks in the provider community in some of these conversations is something that costs all of us dearly.
Well, certainly something I've noticed as a reporter is that the blog community on technology is most speedy when it is angry. And so, which raises issues, because I have used searches of blogs or Twitter posts to try to gauge the reaction of the higher ed IT community to a bit of news, particularly involving, say, a corporate a merger, a new policy, a court decision, and generally the people who post first are the people who have a very firmly held view of the situation before this news development and who are mad about it. It takes longer to write a post that says, this is a very nuanced question and here are some issues I'd want to track down the road, than to post, this is, yet again a really stupid decision by, and then fill in the blanks. And I worry about it, because on the one hand, as a journalist, and I would think for policy people as well, the blogs provide a great way to get a sense of what people who aren't deemed official think about something going on, but it's not really a scientific poll. Casey?
Yeah, Josh, I'm sorry. Can I go on record saying that there's stupidity on both sides? It's just one side is easier as a bigger target mm-hmm. than the other? Certainly, none of you, of course, but perhaps some of your campus colleagues or the place where you used to work, occasionally did something stupid, and sometimes the tendency, I think, on the part of campuses is to bury that, and then the tendency on the part of people on campus is to attack it when it's done on the part of the provider community. I think the second analog to that is in terms of where you get a lot of voice, one has to do with discussion about the technology providers, but the second is if you go into the political area, even if you do it on humor. I did that with one of my digital tweet columns some years ago, making a passing reference to the second year into the what I called the Bush 2 recession, because it was during the early part of this decade as opposed to the last decade, and got just a blistering attack by a faculty member at one institution who said, I'm not an economist, there is no recession, and went on after me. And I wrote back a very polite response to say, yes, I'm not an economist, but I have great respect for Ronald Reagan, who, as a 1919 graduate of Eureka College, was an economics major. And Mr. Reagan explained a depression and a recession for many of us by saying the difference between when you lose a job and your neighbor loses a job. Sent that back to the guy, and he ranted at me again. So the whole issue, you have to be very careful, I think, in some of these also with humor and politics as much as some of the other issues in talking about the activities of either campuses or tech providers.
Absolutely. I'd very much like to get the audience here involved. Are there any of the bloggers here who would like to share anything about their experiences with these or other issues, or to pose questions for our panel? not all at once. Then let me ask the panelists again, sort of another question on: do you which tech blogs aside from ours do you follow, and who do you find worth reading?
Well, I read a lot of Read Write Web. Say that 8 times fast, and you'll come up with some interesting words. And really, I use RSS a lot, so I just bring in 350 plus different feeds that I look through and sort of try to find some inspiration from. And I also read a lot of university blogs. A lot of the blogs coming out of admissions offices, or for example, like MIT, their bloggers are often really entertaining, and it's coming from a student voice, and they share a lot of really neat stuff. So I'll read that, but it's not just technology things. It could be, XKCD, for example. Who's an XKCD reader? Admit it, it's fine. See, exactly. You print out the comics, you know you do. You cut it out the box. It's perfectly normal. And I read just a lot of different things, but I think the biggest thing is I read Twitter voraciously, because Twitter is a great place to find inspiration for posts, comments, and just themes, because you can use something like TweetDeck, for example, to just sort of listen to what's being said. If you do a TweetDeck search for example, academic advisors, you're going to get everything from "I love my academic advisor" to "My academic advisor is pond scum." Yeah. Below pond scum. Yeah, absolutely.
Josh?
Yeah, I mean, my experience with blogging, and the truth is that the more I produce and the more I have opportunities to produce, the less I consume. And that's just been my experience over time. And what I find is, though, even though I'm consuming a lot less content, I feel like having the opportunity or the discipline to try to sit down each day and bring together what I'm thinking and it helps me consolidate in my own mind what's going on in my field and my industry. So what I do is in my job at Dartmouth, I'm the director of learning and technology for a program that's designing hybrid and blended courses. So we're doing course design, learning design, and I very much see the connection between blogging and teaching and learning. That my experience is that I haven't really understood this world or the world I live in until I'm forced to write about it and think about it and synthesize it. I think that we don't have our students doing enough of this. I think it would be really wonderful if we had our students integrating and synthesizing and writing and producing the way we're starting to, that blogging gives us the opportunity to do. So again, I'd say I'm consuming a lot less, Scott.
Casey?
Yeah, I'm an erratic reader. Of course, I religiously read everything that comes in from that's done by the four technology bloggers at Inside Higher Ed. Tracy Matrona, who was not able to be here with us, we tried to beam her in and just we're not able to do that. I am perpetually overwhelmed by the fact that Josh was able to post 7 times a week and I'm barely able to get one out. I feel like he's the guy who's raising the curve in the class every now and then, but I applaud his efforts for that and his energies. Occasionally, I take more of the stuff that I read is actually comes to me via Google searches when I'm looking at topics, as opposed to reading individual bloggers. Of folks out there, sort of in an interesting crossover position, I think the stuff that Michael Feldstein does is interesting and informative, analytic in terms of both campus and industry issues. Michael is also in kind of an interesting nexus point because he works for Oracle. He's on the Sakai board. He used to have an academic appointment, I believe, at one of the SUNY campuses. So sort of brings kind of that, let me touch a couple of different perspectives on some of his work as well. And some of the stuff on TechCrunch and a lot of some of the other industry things as well, just to sort of keep myself trying to sort of play the catch up on stuff that's just sort of pouring out from the tech industry and looking for, does this stuff have any potential application to, not immediately, but over time, because the diffusion curve is a little more difficult on campus than it is in the consumer market for a lot of this stuff. And I think that's the other thing that we all live in the shadow of, is that the conversation of expectations has shifted. For those of us with gray or thinning hair, or in the case of the ladies, perhaps it's brightly colored, the technology experience is no longer a rite of passage. Getting your first email account when you went to college in 1985 or 97 or 2000. The fact is that our students of whatever age come to us wired. And that, too, I think, is in and of itself is an interesting issue in terms of the landscape these days.
Within the higher ed blog, yes, please. And if you could introduce yourself and your institution and or blog.
For sure. Pete Juvenal, Illinois State University.
I had a question. What's been the topic that you've had the most response from, and has any of those responses surprised you? Any of our
course catalogs? People are passionate about course catalogs, I got to tell you. I've never met one that I really liked or that I thought was aesthetically pleasing or extremely usable, and that post blew up with comments, and who knew?
Josh or Casey?
I am the youngest, not chronologically, but the newest of the four tech bloggers inside higher ed, and my first post was something about e-books year two. And there were not a lot of comments, but other emails or hallway comments that came back to me about that. The intent was to sort of map where we are in the wake of last year's pilots that a couple of campuses did with Amazon and the launch of the iPad and a lot of other industries as part of the supply chain into what will be e-books for the academic community. So some of the comments come in other ways other than being posted on the IHE website through the comment channel.
And in thinking about this, I'm realizing that one of the best communities for back and forth are people who work in libraries and librarians. They are amazing how engaged they are. One of the great things about blogging, and one of the things I hope maybe we can discuss, is that I think blogs give all of us at colleges and universities the ability to have an independent, autonomous voice. And at colleges and universities, unfortunately, it's often only the faculty that are, say, they get this privilege, and people who work in administration don't. So I've also found that when you can engage this group who often doesn't feel like they do have the right or the privilege to talk about what they're thinking about and talk for their institution, then I think you get a lot of back and forth, and that's really interesting.
And one other question as well. We were chatting on Twitter a moment ago about editing comments.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever been in a situation where you've had a comment that was derogatory and incendiary towards someone else, was way off the subject, or just you felt the need to delete, how did you handle that, and did they respond?
Eric took me to task for one of my recent posts because I was in tongue-in-cheek, titled it, "Can You Explain IT to Your Mom?" And it really was intended to be tongue-in-cheek, and he rightly took me to task to saying, why are we picking on moms? My mother's 85, and I've never been able to explain to her whatever it is that I do in my academic work or my job, even prior to technology. Probably not. In retrospect, that's one of the points, and I've taken my editors to task lightly for it as well. You guys are supposed to save me from myself. If it had been a column, they might have. With a blog, they've told me they're just going to take a quick look at it, see that it's not libelous as opposed to dangerous to one of us, and let it go. So that's the case. So what I try to do, I do a lot of editing along the way, and the best writing is constant rewriting. Fortunately, it's a lot easier to do it now than it used to be when it was pen and paper or a typewriter. I think that level of responsibility is elevated for bloggers. You have to really take that responsibility more so than if you have that one intermediate step of working with an editor before submission.
Our policy at Inside Higher Ed on comments is we have a bar, but a low bar to post a comment. We make sure it's not spam, that it's not libelous, and that it's on topic. But we don't do a sort of traditional letter to the editor judgment of, does this comment add to the quality of discussion? And by having even a low bar, we have offended some purists, I guess, about the internet as a free and open exchange, who send me emails when they're upset when they get back a note that says your comment is being reviewed and will be posted. That bothers them. We also sometimes get criticism from people who think we should have a higher bar and apply a, does it really add to the discussion? I notice on certain issues, both for our blogs and for our news stories, there are sometimes organized efforts to bombard us with comments and to bombard me as the editor with nasty email, discouraging coverage or certain points of view. Right now, this is very much the case on anything to do with immigration. In the technology world, it was particularly notable at the time of the Blackboard D2L litigation, where anything we wrote, either a blog opinion piece or news story, resulted in lots of comments and emails saying either that we were totally on the side of one side or the other, and actually would simultaneously get accused of being in both camps. The difficulty, we had no problem printing comments that were very harshly attacking our coverage, but many times the commenters would then veer in to say, you know, and furthermore, we know that Company X is really part of Al-Qaeda. And, you know, and so you have to, you know, you can't publish stuff like that, or at least I believe it is irresponsible to. And so the venom that gets attached by real partisans on issues goes a long way. You know, I'm curious as well, one of the big issues that gets debated in blogging is anonymous versus named blogs. And obviously all of you and all of our tech bloggers are named. We have other bloggers at Inside Higher Ed, and there are many in higher education who are anonymous. And I'm wondering if our panel thinks that when you're looking at a blog post, do you judge it in part based on whether you know who the person is? And or do you think less of an anonymous blog?
Well, personally, I've been blogging at ericstoller.com, fairly anonymous, since about 2004. So for me, it's been sort of just a sort of personal ethos around what I hope to bring to the table, which is as much transparency as possible. And so if a blog's been around for quite a while and it's an anonymous blog, they blog under a handle or something, and they're writing good content sort of rises to the top no matter what. If they do provide a comment and they comment as Commodore 64, maybe it could be a little suspect. And obviously I try to bring Commodore 64 into any event that I'm at, so you can now say that that's been done.
I get frustrated with anonymity in a variety of venues. I get frustrated when when there's just the Commodore 64, if it's a comment on one of my blogs, whether it's with due respect, for example, to the Chronicle of Higher Education, the other major source in higher ed, a lot of the columns that they publish where people are writing under a pseudonym. And I understand the reason why they feel they need to be protected, you know, an assistant professor at a Midwestern liberal arts college or at a state university, because these things are sensitive. And it does take – there is some risk, as we said at the beginning of the conversation, about going public with your name in an academic career. If you have a faculty position, particularly if you have a junior faculty position. So I'm on both sides of it. I understand the reason that some people would do it. I wish people would not, but you know, recognize the need for folks either to be protected or feel that they need to protect themselves from their colleagues.
Josh, anything on this?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about this a lot. I mean, I do think it's important. I mean, I think it's better for all of us to blog with our own names because we're trying to build a community and get to know each other. And that's one of the things that bloggers can do. On the other side of that, when I blog, I often blog, most of my blogs are questions. And I find that's a very easy way to write a blog, is that I have tons of questions about how things work. And a blog is a great place to get those out. Sometimes by writing the questions, it helps you sort of think about it, and then sometimes you get feedback. So for instance, I have lots of questions about our professional organization, about EDUCAUSE. I mean, I care about this organization deeply, and I plan to spend the next 40, 50 years as a part of this organization. But I think about, well, what I write, am I going to piss people off? And I don't want to do that, right, because I care about this organization, but I do have the questions. So I do think there's lots and lots of advantages of blogging as yourself, but there are some costs, and I think that's one of the costs.
One of the things on our comments, and this is both for blogs and news stories, we let people post anonymously, but we require them to give an email so that we can confirm, if necessary, that they are who they say they are. And the reason we decided to give the possibility of anonymous comments was examples like what Casey was talking about with, you know, the untenured professor who is taking a bold stand. One of the things I have been surprised, though, is that we have a number of regular anonymous commenters who are college and university presidents. And I have emailed some of them and said, hey, why aren't you putting your name? It would mean something if they saw that you said this. And the answer is invariably, if you're at a certain level, not only do you have to fear pissing people off, but you have to focus so much on making everybody love you and love you enough to write a check that it's just not worth it. And so these are people who care enough about the topics to engage, but are absolutely committed to not posting their name. Similarly, I've had the same experience where I have approached tenured professors who have more job security than any of our panelists and probably than most of you in this room, who also choose not to. And it is an interesting issue. Of those of you with blogs, do any of you require people to post to use their names? Interesting. I'd really like to welcome your comments about your experiences with blogs. If anybody would like to get into the conversation.
I'm sorry, Scott, so somebody's walking up for myself and perhaps for the other panelists.
Sure.
Anytime a college president posts an anonymous comment, will you let us know privately?
I won't let you know who.
Because
we have assured them. It's not. But what Inside Higher Ed started in 2005, which was right about the time that Larry Summers was imploding at Harvard, and the popular fake email address by people who didn't want to be contacted was LarrySummers@gmail.com. But no, in fact, he wasn't regularly commenting. Yes, sir.
Has Larry commented on mine?
Not to my knowledge.
On Joshua's?
he is not a regular. He's busy with the whole economy thing.
Got it. All right. Thanks.
I'm just going to say that one of my favorite comments was from Dwayne Todd, who is Associate VP and Dean of Students at Columbus College of Art. He's on the task force for the core competencies for ACPA and NASPA, which is going through a discussion right now on whether or not to consolidate the two associations. And his comment, as someone who's out there professionally in the student affairs world, his comment probably could have crushed me, but at the same time, it's furthering the dialogue, and at least they took the courage to put their name out there and to really write a thoughtful response, which then enables other folks to tag on to that thought process, that theme, that thread. And I don't know, I'm really appreciative when professionals are out there and they're willing to take that courage to put their name behind what they say, because maybe I'm just all about, I'm from Oregon, right, so it's all about granola. I literally had some this morning. It makes the world a better place in my view, because it takes a lot more courage to put your name behind a comment like that.
Yes, sir.
So my name is Andy Peterson, and I'm a president of Reformed Theological Seminary, the virtual campus. And just as sort of a little case study with all this talent here and the Twitter group and so on, I have a question about which I have interest that I think is important for EDUCAUSE and for our industry. Why is Apple not here? Why do they not have an exhibit?
Maybe
everybody knows, but it just seems to me, it's kind of one of the top three influences in our business, yeah. And they're not here.
I would not presume to speak for Apple, unless is there anybody from Apple in the room? But I will tell you sort of the scuttlebutt, because I've certainly heard lots of gossip about it, with many people seeming annoyed by it, but many also saying that it's sort of a classic Apple move to feel that it doesn't have to do things that everybody else does. So people are both, what I've heard is people both annoyed and like, oh yeah, that's an Apple thing to do. And I'm not passing judgment, but that's what I've heard. Anything the panelists would want to add on that?
That kind of question is exactly the kind of thing that I'd blog about and you guys would blog about. Like, the questions are more important, right? I mean, I know that fact that Apple's not here, I look at the companies that come because I feel like they're supporting what we're trying to do in educational technology, and it matters to me that Apple's not here. It makes me think less well of them, and that matters as I go about my business, working out of college. So I think that's a perfect example of, if you wonder it, and I'd ask you, are you blogging and asking these kind of questions?
And we're really big into iTunes U. We love all, the iPad, all that. Apple's been at EDUCAUSE in the past. you know, so they've given a lot and so on. It's just, it really is an open question.
And if we all emailed Steve Jobs, one of us would get a response. Yeah. And it would probably be fantastic.
Good.
I'll tell you something else that really surprised me. On Tuesday night, actually at an event celebrating the anniversary of the Campus Computing Project, I met somebody from Apple Higher Education Australia. I asked, and I didn't get an answer, but I asked that person because I was struck that Apple Higher Ed in Australia had thought this was a meeting to attend. Or maybe it was just Casey's party was the reason to cross the ocean. So obviously Apple is aware of the higher ed market, but that just struck me as odd given that they didn't have it.
Yeah, as you know, it's almost a religious decision, you know, PC, Apple, that kind of went away, but it's still around. So, you know, it'd be great to have them interact. But I understand the positioning part, too, about, you know, we're busy focusing on all this. So thanks. That's
Thanks for asking the question. Yes.
Hi. I'm Jason Jones. I'm at Central Connecticut State University, and I'm also one of the editors of ProfHacker, which is a blog about pedagogy and technology at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And I guess I want to talk a little bit about ask and then turn it into a question, I promise, about comments, because our commenting policy is actually pretty draconian. We're not afraid to delete comments that we think are unhelpful to a particular topic, and we're not afraid to we've banned a couple of users already, and in part because we want to develop a community of practice, right? So it seems to me that rather than adopting a one-size-fits-all approach to commenting for different blogs, a lot depends on what your goals are, right? Like, a lot of y'all are getting information out there, provoking conversation among lots of different groups, and so you need more diverse kinds of comments. But if you're trying to get someone to risk saying, "Oh, maybe I will try that," then you need to have a space where they're not going to be called an idiot, you know, for at least, you know, a day or two online, right? I mean, that happens a lot. And so I guess the question I wanted to come back to is, what kinds of communities for the bloggers, what kinds of communities do you envision building over time, right? How have you seen your blogs turning into a community of either like-minded or diverse-minded readers as you've gone?
Right? I mean, Josh, you've been doing this the longest, so I wonder if you might have the best sense of that.
Yeah, I mean, the community that I think I'm most interested in are people who often don't get a voice. So I think those are the people who have followed non-traditional careers and haven't been able to get into those sort of few tenure slotted. The people who are not at the decision-making places at their companies but would like to get there at some point and who really care passionately about that. I think up until blogging and social media, there has not been a place for people like that, for people like me, to get out there in this conversation. And I very much think that the only way you can be an effective leader when you get there is to go through the processes, to make the mistakes, to build the communities, to build those relationships. So I would say that in terms of a community of practice, those are the people that I'm most interested in connecting with.
Something that I've noticed among our bloggers, technology and otherwise, is that the blog communities, the communities that form, are more personal in many cases, and narrower than, say, the broad inside higher ed community, which I think is great. And I think an ethos does actually develop on some of the blogs about what the blog is about. So, for instance, we have this blog, Mama PhD, and we would never ban a man, say, from posting on it. In fact, we get very thoughtful posts from fathers. When we started the blog, and about once every 6 months, some guy feels obliged to say, "This is sexist that you have a blog called Mama PhD. How could you do that?" And it's just, you know, frankly, not the most intelligent contribution, but people sort of go on. That doesn't dominate the discussion. What I like most about the communities is actually a variation of what Josh said. I think that the official voices in higher education are too narrow, too cautious, and just frankly don't have all the best ideas. If you look at who makes op-ed pages, they tend to be big-name institutions, big-name people. Half the time it's being written by somebody other than the person, him or herself. And I think the blogging world, what to me is exciting about it and why I like having it on Inside Higher Ed is I think it's truly more of a meritocracy. I think if you don't have anything good to say, no one's going to read you, but there is an openness to reading people who aren't yet famous. And so I think that is a, to me, real value. And then I want to answer a Twitter question, which is how have blogs affected Inside Higher Ed's brand for better or for worse? I think very much for better. I think we embraced them from the beginning with links to blog posts, including some of yours, and coverage of blogs, taking bloggers seriously as sources for ideas. And I think that's very important. I think one of the messages we wanted to convey was that we do believe there's this wider world of higher education ideas out there, and that you don't have to be famous or at a famous institution to be worth listening to. Early on, some people, we are also unusual in that we have traditional news pieces, traditional op-eds, although it's all online, and blogs, and that confuses some people. But I think as time goes on, I think that's going to be the norm in journalism, and it doesn't seem to confuse as many people now as it did when we started.
Scott, I think also one of the, at least for me and perhaps for others, I think one of the roles implicitly or explicitly, certainly it is for the Digital Tweed blog, is to be the loyal opposition with an emphasis on loyal and tactful and respectful to a point, but also the opposition, and to both bring information and hopefully some insight to an audience. And in my case, I don't view my audience to be exclusively the IT community, because I'm hoping I'm reaching other audiences, whether it's the technology provider community or folks in academic affairs or the anonymous college president who may occasionally pick up my stuff, because I'm not typically writing about a particular company or a particular issue, but how the blending of these things, and in one sense the digitization of academic culture and what these tools and resources do or could do and the potential they have.
And we've got time for one more comment or question.
This is just about the relationship between blogging and the IHE brand. And Scott's being far too modest here, right? I mean, to a certain extent, Inside Higher Ed helped save academic blogging in 2005, 2006 at times, and many institutions were in fact quite skeptical, and lots of us who are around 2003, 2002 and ongoing owe a real debt to Inside Higher Ed for linking out so broadly and for helping create precisely that meritocracy of leadership of voices and readership that Scott described. So don't be so.
Well, you're very kind. I'd like to thank all of you for coming this morning. If any of you don't get our daily news alert, which tells you all the new blogs, come give me your card and I'll get you on the list. If you want the opportunity to shake hands with some of the best bloggers in higher education, please come join us and thank our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.